Good evening. Trump's executive order on police reform avoids talk of race. A report from an eyewitness to an anarchist enclave in Seattle. And the Supreme Court rules LGBTQ people can keep their jobs. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with some of the news for Tuesday, June 16th, 2020. India's army says 20 of its soldiers were killed in hand-to-hand clashes with Chinese troops at a disputed border site. It's a major escalation of a weeks-long standoff between the two Asian giants in the Western Himalayas. China's foreign ministry confirmed there had been a violent physical confrontation on Monday in the border area. An Indian government source said the troops had fought with iron rods and stones and that no shots had been fired. The deaths were the first since the last major border clash in 1967. Between the nuclear-armed neighbors. And on Tuesday, North Korea blew up a joint liaison office set up in a border town in 2018 to foster better ties with South Korea. The North threatened action if defectors continued with a campaign of sending propaganda leaflets north of the armistice line between the two nations. Destruction of the building, closed since January due to coronavirus, is a further blow to President Donald Trump's hopes of persuading North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons. North Korea last week warned Washington to refrain from commenting on inter-Korean affairs if it wanted the its presidential election to go smoothly, raising concerns of a return to nuclear and long-range missile testing. South Korea's National Security Council said Seoul would respond sternly if North Korea continued to raise tensions. And in Washington, following weeks of national protests since the death of George Floyd, President Trump signed an executive order Tuesday that he said would encourage better police practices. But he made no mention of the national debate over racism spawned by police killings of black men and women.
Despite our very good record on crime, law and order must be further restored nationwide, and your federal government is ready, willing, and able to help. As we did in Minneapolis after it got out of control for 4 days, we sent in representatives, commonly known as the National Guard, and it was all put down very quickly. We're willing to help. We're willing to help in Seattle. We're willing to help anywhere you want, and we'll be there very quickly. It won't take long. Under the executive order I'm signing today, we will prioritize federal grants from the Department of Justice to police departments that seek independent credentialing, certifying that they meet high standards, and in fact, in certain cases, the highest standard. That's where they do the best, on the use of force and de-escalation training. For example, many believe that proper training might have prevented the tragic deaths of Antoine Rose and Botham Jean. As part of this new credentialing process, chokeholds will be banned, except if an officer's life is at risk. Additionally, we're looking at new advanced and powerful, less lethal weapons to help prevent deadly interactions. New devices are being developed all the time, and we're looking at the best of them. And cost is no object, no object. Under this executive order, departments will also need a share of information about credible abuses so that officers with significant issues do not simply move from one police department to the next. That's a problem. And the heads of our police department said, whatever you can do about that, please let us know. We're letting you know. We're doing a lot about it. In addition, my order will direct federal funding to support officers in dealing with homeless individuals and those who have mental illness and substance abuse problems. We will provide more resources for co-responders, such as social workers who can help officers manage these complex encounters. We will have reform without undermining our many great and extremely talented law enforcement officers.
Amnesty International USA said the order amounts to a Band-Aid for a bullet wound, but Trump framed his plan as an alternative to the defund the police movement. Trump met privately with the families of several black victims of police violence before his Rose Garden signing ceremony. and said he grieved for the lives lost and families devastated. When the police retreated from the East Precinct in Seattle last week, protesters set up barriers in the streets and announced it was now the Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone, or CHAZ. But over the weekend, the Capitol Hill organized protest was formed to replace CHAZ, named CHOP. It was because organizers realized, or said they realized, if they were really autonomous, they couldn't make demands on the government. The three major demands of the occupation are de-gentrification of Seattle, restoration of city funds for arts and culture, and free college for people in the state of Washington as a form of reparations for black people to redress past wrongs. The occupation has drawn thousands into the zone as cops pulled out of a local police station, and Trump raged at Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkan's decision to allow the protest. Francesca is a local resident who's been at CHOP since almost the beginning. She says violence decreased after the police left.
So I came down Monday evening. I grabbed a pair of grabbers and a trash bag, and I just started cleaning. I figured that if this is the Black Lives Matter, then what I can do to help support and give them the voice is I can help keep the area clean. And because if we're going to stay there, we're going to need to make sure that we are working with our neighbors who are now that we're going in and occupying. So I've been doing that since Monday. I think Tuesday I didn't go, but I've been there every day since at some point. And in the middle of that, I was able to get set up two different tents inside of Cal Anderson Park, which is the main park that's being occupied. And one tent is for ecology. So I've got a bunch of grabbers. I've got trash bags. I have gloves. I have sanitizer. It's all there ready to go. So that way, if people want to, they can come pick up trash. And I'll tell you that ever since I set it up, I mean, people are utilizing it, and the park is extremely clean on the inside. The other tent that I have set up, it's been up for just under 48 hours, and it is a free clothing and personal items exchange. And it's also, it's run by Anarchy. And what I mean by that is that I set up the building, I brought in tables, I posted a sign saying what it was, and it's just been running itself. Nobody is required to be there. People continuously appear to be volunteering, and they'll walk up and say, hi, how are you? What are you guys doing? They'll tell me, oh, we're a free clothing exchange, and they're just working. And I'll say, oh, that's great. Did you know I set up this tent? And they'll say, no, I didn't know that. And so I'll just remind them that I'm super glad that they're there, that they are there on their own time, and that they are welcome to leave whenever. They are not required to have any sort of relief, that it's just going to run itself. Anybody can take anything. What I've been telling people is that if somebody walks up and has 10 tents and they drop them off and somebody comes up right behind them and takes five of them, we're not going to ask them any questions. And that's how it's running. And it's been beautiful.
How many people are there, do you think? Do you have a number on people?
There are thousands of people coming through each day since the cops have left. I can tell you as an observer, as somebody who has personally been accosted by that particular precinct, actually, there were people who were out on the streets. They wanted to march past. They didn't want to go into it. They didn't want to break into it. They didn't want to steal anything. They just wanted to walk past it. And the cops, being fearful of what was happening around, I think it was the Globe, honestly. So they stood there and they beat people with rubber bullets and tear gas because they threw a couple of bottles. I'm not saying people should be throwing bottles, but I'm saying that tear gas is not an appropriate reaction to bottles. When they stepped back, they left. They just took everything out in a rush. Some people were able to go back in, I think, with some media. So it wasn't people breaking in, and they saw it was just completely trashed in there. And we don't know why it was trashed in there because we haven't been in there. There seems to be this idea that there was a battle for the precinct, but nobody wanted the precinct. This is something that I am hearing from people who were there from day one. They never wanted to take over the precinct. Nobody's been inside without being allowed inside.
Hard to make out, but it seemed like two people were holding some sort of weaponry, and there was talk in the media that it was like an armed camp, and that somehow there were checkpoints and people were being asked for money, and that there was conflict over who was in charge. What was all that about?
You know, I can't tell you what that's all about. I don't know where people got that idea. I will say that, yes, there are people who are utilizing their Second Amendment right, and there is open carry. Now, I'll remind you that Washington State is an open carry state. So there's really no conversation about whether or not there's weapons. It doesn't matter because it's their right. Now, as far as checking IDs go, it has been talked about a number of times that is not something that anybody wants to do, but everybody's volunteers. So maybe somebody showed up, volunteered, and started asking people for IDs. Well, I'll tell you that person, if that even happened, because I don't think it did, but if it ever happened, well, they were wrong. And they will hopefully have now been told so or asked not to go work the barriers or what have you. Nobody's being ID'd. And just on the topic of how it is as far as blending with the community that was already there, I know that there was a meeting today that happened talking about how can we keep the occupation while also making sure that the people who are there are able to do what they were already doing as well. And we're not telling anybody who lived there that they can't be there, that they can't leave. None of this. Of course they can go to work. And in fact, all of the businesses that are inside of the quote unquote occupation, they're open and they're running.
It seems like more an extension of the Occupy movement.
I would agree with that, but a lot of the differences between what's happening between the Occupy Seattle and what's happening now is that at Occupy Seattle, I personally witnessed police officers taking food out of people's hands and saying, you can't feed that to people. I personally witnessed officers stomping on tents because they decided that was camping. I personally was almost arrested for sitting down and eating a sandwich inside of the park during the daytime because they considered that camping. I mean, Occupy was insane and the cops would not allow it to happen. The difference is the cops are gone. That is what the difference is. As far as the safety inside of it, again, we are working on making sure there was a meeting today about making sure that if emergency services greater than what we already have, because we have EMTs there constantly, but if somebody needed to call 911 and needed those emergency services, they are working out a way to make sure that those can be accessed. We weren't expecting to have this happen. We didn't expect the cops to leave and give us the space. So we're figuring it out, and we want to work with our community.
How's this going to end? Yeah.
Well, the only way that I want to see it end is with more services out in the community, a defunding of the police. We don't need cops as much as people think we do.
Francesca is a local resident from Seattle who's been at the CHOP, the Capitol Hill Occupation Zone, or organized protests since almost the beginning. She says violence decreased after the police left. Mayor Durkin had mocked Trump's demand for heavy-handed action. She told the president, go back to your bunker. And as anger bubbles in parts of the country, some U.S. police departments are facing their own crises, and some officers have now opted to walk away. In Minneapolis, where the killing of George Floyd sparked the uprisings against police brutality, 7 officers have resigned. 8 resigned in Atlanta after the killing of Rayshard Brooks. 10 officers in a South Florida SWAT unit have called it quits. And in Buffalo, New York, nearly 60 officers resigned from the force's emergency response team over the suspension of 2 police officers who were caught in a video pushing an elderly protester to the ground. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. In Washington, 2 conservative members of the United States Supreme Court produced a landmark decision for the gay rights movement by ruling that federal anti-bias law covers millions of gay, lesbian, and transgender workers. The 6-3 decision was written by Justice Neil Gorsuch, President Donald Trump's first high court appointee. The decision was joined by Chief Justice John Roberts, who had never signed an opinion endorsing gay rights. The majority ruled that Title VII of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which prohibits discrimination because of sex, extends to people who face job bias arising from their sexual orientation or gender identity. A professor of law at Columbia University, Suzanne Goldberg, says the decision is groundbreaking.
I am thrilled and more than a little bit surprised. This is a very important ruling recognizing that the federal sex discrimination law that prohibits sex discrimination in employment protects LGBT people from discrimination. It's the right ruling. It's just not necessarily what we expected from the current court, and it's a very important one.
Have you had a chance to actually read the decision, the opinions, and to see what it is that motivated people who you didn't think would vote for that?
The language of the law says that employers may not discriminate against individual employees based on sex, as well as on race, color, religion, and national origin. But the big question in the case was, well, what does sex mean? And does sex discrimination mean that an employer can still fire someone because they don't like that they're gay or they don't like that they're transgender? And what the court said was that when we look at the text, we can't see a way to think about discriminating against a gay person or against a transgender person other than thinking that that person is being discriminated against because they don't fit with what the employer expects of a man or a woman, right? They exist in the world in a way that would be okay for some men or some women, but not for them. And the key factor there is sex. And so that it's kind of the plain language of the law, if you will.
Does that tell you that these two Trump appointees might be doing something different than Mr. Trump or other people expected in future cases?
We have to see. You know, this is a particular kind of case because the court was asked to interpret one word in a statute. I don't think this is necessarily a predictor of how the court will approach questions about what the Constitution's equality guarantee means for all people, or even, frankly, what the equality guarantee means for LGBT people. The very kind of particular way in which courts approach understanding what Congress meant when it used the word sex in the law.
So this is a very specific thing to a specific case that happened to go the way of LGBTQ rights activists and advocates.
I don't want to reduce the importance of the case. It is tremendously important because the court was able to see that sex discrimination law has to protect people who don't conform to the employer's expectations or preferences about who a man or woman is. So what the court did, which was very important, is it was invited by the Trump administration, by the federal government, to carve a big hole in sex discrimination law and say, well, it doesn't apply to LGBT people, and the court refused that invitation. And that will affect all, or it should affect all, interpretations of sex discrimination laws at the federal level. So it's very, very important. It just doesn't necessarily tell us what will happen with the next Voting Rights Act case or the next case in which a group challenges discrimination by the government under the Constitution's guarantee of equality.
Just quickly, a half a minute, what's the history of this law? How long has it been kicking around? You know, the case that led up to this decision, how long has that been kicking around, and does it have a history of interest?
This law, Title VII, is part of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which provided a wide range of protections from the federal government to people who are discriminated against in a variety of ways, including, like I said, race, color, religion, national origin, and sex. And over many years, the court has asked the question, well, what do different parts of this law mean? With respect to sex discrimination, the court decades ago recognized that sex discrimination covers sexual harassment. It recognized that it covers sex stereotyping. So we have seen over time the court apply this law in ways that, in some ways, that provide greater protection to individual employees.
How is this going to affect tomorrow the rights of LGBTQ people?
It provides a remedy when someone is discriminated against. They can try to go to court and win a case. I think even more importantly and more powerfully, it tells employers that they should not and must not tolerate discrimination in their workplaces. This doesn't mean the end to all discrimination, but it does really significantly shift the landscape.
Suzanne Goldberg is a professor at Columbia University's Center for Gender and Sexuality. The Trump administration had argued against Monday's outcome. And in state news, Governor Andrew Cuomo says the COVID-19 pandemic is coming under control in New York, although he says the areas hardest hit are in the state's poorest regions.
The facts in New York are very, very good. And I am so proud of what the people in this state have done the past 5 days. New York City was 1.2 yesterday. When we started opening New York City, 1.5, 1.7, 1.4, 1.3, 1.2. So the number hasn't gone up. If anything, it's relatively constant. You're going to see those little ups and downs. That's basically true all across the board. You see little fluctuations, but nothing concerning. We have the lowest number of hospitalizations since we started. Amen. And we have the lowest number of deaths since we started. Once again, same numbers yesterday, but on the three-day average, we are at a new low. This was always a balance of public health versus the personal relationships and people who are in hospitals who desperately want to see loved ones and loved ones who want to see people in hospitals. But we're going to allow hospitals to start accepting visitors at their discretion, pursuant to state guidelines that have limited visits, PPE, temperature checks, et cetera. Obviously, we need to be careful, but same thing with group homes. This Friday, the group homes can allow visitors. It is up to the discretion of the group home. They have to tell the state if they're allowing visitors. And again, they have to follow state guidelines, masks, et cetera. We've reviewed the Capital Region data, and we're going to go to phase three tomorrow in the Capital Region, so we're excited about that. We're excited about the U.S. Open is going to be held in Queens August 31st to September 13th. It will be held without fans, but we can watch it on TV, and I'll take that. The tennis authority is going to be taking extraordinary precautions, but that's going to occur in Queens.
And that's Governor Cuomo. Meanwhile, according to researchers in the United Kingdom, the widely available steroid drug dexamethasone may be key in helping to treat the sickest COVID-19 patients who require ventilation or oxygen. The findings are preliminary, still being compiled, and have not been published in a peer-reviewed journal. Dexamethasone is typically used to treat certain forms of arthritis, severe allergies, and asthma, among other conditions, including certain types of cancer. And in city news, yesterday, tenant advocates exposed the worst evictors in New York City and highlighted the growing threat of mass evictions that black renters face. The rollout of the worst evictors list comes amid growing concerns that black renters in communities hit hardest by COVID-19 are particularly at risk of losing their homes when New York's current eviction moratorium expires June 20th. Any renter who can't prove lost income due to COVID-19 will be vulnerable to eviction when housing courts reopen later this month. Landlords on the worst evictors list include a number of well-known corporate property owners with large portfolios of rental buildings in black and brown neighborhoods in New York City. But joining the list of joining the list for dishonorable mention was the city's biggest landlord, NYCHA. The Right to Counsel New York City Coalition headed up the conference.
Well, the landlords may soon be able to sue, and housing court is going to reopen. We know that. But also we know it's unthinkable to evict people during this time. So what are we going to have the whole city? Homeless? Everyone's going to be homeless? These demands are moral. Our demands are reasonable.
Hello, my name is Jocelyn Gomez. I unfortunately live in the building of the number one evictor, Ved Prakash, and he doesn't care. He doesn't show any care about families with children. He doesn't even care if you're also going through family court. And his son doesn't care either, who's now the administrator. And I think that Prakash can only be moved through protest and through mobilizing. The only thing he doesn't like is when we get active.
This statement is from Alta Grace, who is a tenant that happens to also be a nurse, so she couldn't be with us here right now, but she submitted a statement describing her living conditions. I've lived in my Newkirk apartment in Flatbush for many years. Moshe Pillar is not a good landlord. He is the worst in my book. In 1993, the building was on city programs due to lack of repairs, and still today, tenants encounter the same problems. I have a continuous leak in my bathroom. Pillar and his staff are malicious towards tenants. Moshe Pillar is always dragging me and other tenants to court for non-payment. I don't owe them back rent. Tenants are afraid to lose their apartments, especially in this crucial moment due to the COVID-19 pandemic. We are out of jobs,
it is unfair for us to lose our place because we can't go to work and get paid. Judges and housing court should make Moshe Piller accountable for his wrongdoings. They should not be in his favor.
We actually have a lot of issues with NYCHA, and so Sasha is actually going to share with us, and they're mentioning our worst evictors list because they have a lot of cases.
My name is Sasha, and I organize with CAV Organizing Asian Communities. We both work with folks in Chinatown and also in public housing at the Queensbridge Houses, which is the biggest public housing complex in the country, as well as in the Ravenswood, Woodside, and Astoria Houses. So we organize working class Asian immigrant tenants who are Chinese, Korean, and Bangladeshi. NYCHA is not only deserves to be a dishonorable mention, but is also a pretty terrible landlord. NYCHA hasn't been cleaning buildings in this pandemic, though they've promised to, making the buildings a literal death trap. It's been a terrifying place for people to live, especially in the last few months. And because the state refuses to fund NYCHA, they're leaving the only public housing in the state and the biggest public housing in the country open to privatization to make it not public housing anymore. Their solution to this coming wave of evictions is something called the Rent Hardship Program. While it exists, it does not work. So we have had members apply and get denied because they couldn't prove that they've lost work, or because they're choosing not to go to their dangerous jobs as elders, as people with health conditions, and therefore can't prove that they lost employment because it's a choice. All of our members who can't prove they've lost work, who are choosing their health over their jobs, are at risk of being evicted from public housing, the place that the state says should be safe, but refuses to fund and refuses to make safe from evictions. This is the same barrier that the state legislature thinks will work at the whole state level, right? They're trying to pass a bill that would require you to prove your income or loss of income in order to get a rent reduction. And what we know in public housing is that that system doesn't work. The only way to stop evictions is to cancel rent. And nobody should be evicted from public housing. The state should not be a dishonorable mention on a worst evictor's list. That means the state is failing us.
The Right to Counsel New York City Coalition. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, June 16, 2020. The news is produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. For the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo.